in about 3 minutes. We're very pleased to have our brother Jim Curry with us once again to give us our third study of the morning, and under the general heading of the Sabbath, our brother Jim now is going to address us upon the subject, "They shall not enter into my rest." Brother Jim, please.
Thanks, Brother Vic. I want to lay the second plank of the foundation of our study this morning, brethren and sisters, by referring to Israel's position in relation to the Sabbath. It's going to teach us a very important principle in connection with what we should be doing as a Sabbath people. It's quite fitting, perhaps, that we should start in Exodus chapter 31, because this chapter sees Moses preparing to come down from the mountain after his absence for 6 days. For a period of time, the glory of Yahweh, of course, had been obscured, and it was seen in chapter 24. His long absence, brethren and sisters, in that place, an absence which prefigures the probation period of the saints of God. He spent all up something like 40 days in that mountain for the first time, and then again, of course, later another 40 days. Probation periods were set forth, and at the end of that period of time, we see him come down from the mountain and find the ecclesia of God in a state of apostasy. And we know that Exodus 32 speaks of the judgment seat of Christ and the separation of those that served God from those who served him not, and the reward given to Levites. Isn't it significant then that the last few things that Moses was told before he came down, brethren and sisters, concerned the sign of the Sabbath day? In Exodus chapter 31, we read in verse 12 that Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, "Speak thou also unto the children of Israel." It wasn't to be a command, it was to be speech. Because this was to be an appeal to willing observation of the principles of the Sabbath. He was to go down and to speak to them, saying, "Verily my Sabbath ye shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that ye may know that I am Yahweh your sanctifier," as those words should be rendered. I am Yahweh your sanctifier. The Sabbath was to be a sign. The word sign there in verse 13 means a signal. And they were to keep the Sabbath. Truly you shall keep the Sabbath. That word keep, of course, is that commonly known Hebrew word, shema, which means to hedge about or to guard or to keep as something very precious. To guard it with your life. You must keep the Sabbath, because it is a signal between you and me for your generations that I am your sanctifier. And so Israel were a Sabbath people. The Sabbath was to represent their sanctification. And we see in this passage that the Sabbath day is locked up together with the name of Yahweh. And we read on in verse 14 that Yahweh, having said that he was their sanctifier, associating the Sabbath with his name, says, "Ye shall keep," here's the same word again, "the Sabbath therefore, for it is holy unto you, it is a sacred thing unto you. Every one that profanes it shall surely be put to death." So you see, brethren and sisters, here were a people who had responsibilities, Sabbath responsibilities, and they were to ensure that the Sabbath day was kept in the way that Yahweh required, in order that they might demonstrate that they were a separate people, that there was a holiness about bearing his name, that he was indeed their sanctifier. And the principle established here in Exodus 31 in these few verses is one that we want to extend this morning in our session on Israel's relationship to the Sabbath. And we shall see ourselves involved in that. Well, of course, they kept the Sabbath one day a week. We keep it every day of the week. And it was a life and death issue for them, as it is for us. For we read at the end of verse 14, "Everyone that profanes it shall surely be put to death. For whosoever shall do any work therein, that soul shall be cut off from among his people." To act as though the day was not holy to them would be to do despite to their calling. It would be equivalent to a repudiation, both of the privilege of membership of the covenant people and of the unparalleled responsibility which went with it. As men treated God, so he would treat them. Those who by their attitude and actions treated their covenant status as of little worth would forfeit it by death. Now that was the force of these words to Israel, brothers and sisters. They were to treat that day as a day of holiness and sanctity. And of course Israel ever did, or at least for most of the time. And certainly in the Lord's day, there was an overt keeping of the Sabbath. But unfortunately, they didn't keep it in the way that he required. They didn't understand that Yahweh didn't want inactivity on the Sabbath. He wanted them to cease from their own works on the Sabbath, that they might do his works. And Israel never understood that principle. They never really did cease from their own works. They might have stopped labouring physically. But as we shall see tomorrow morning, God willing, in Isaiah 58, in their minds they went on with their own works. They didn't stop thinking about their own things on the Sabbath day. And that's the principle of the Sabbath as far as we are concerned. There's got to be a cessation from our own thinking and from our own works that we might devote ourselves to the work of our God. And it was the positive aspect that Israel never understood. So we read in verse 15 that he lays down these laws concerning the Sabbath. 6 days may work be done, but in the seventh is the Sabbath of rest. It's interesting that in this context from verse 12 onwards to verse 17 that Sabbath occurs 7 times. 6 times as the word Sabbath and once as the word Sabbathon. We have that word Sabbathon there in verse 15, the word rest. So 7 times in the context the Sabbath is referred to, that they might understand that Yahweh here is speaking about their responsibility to him because of the covenant that he had made with them. They were a covenant people. I am Yahweh, your sanctifier. I have set you apart for myself. So therefore, whosoever doeth any work in the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Wherefore the children, or the ben, the family builders of Israel, shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations, for a perpetual covenant. That word perpetual there is olam. It means, of course, the hidden period. It's a principle to be carried into the kingdom. It is to be a perpetual covenant into the kingdom. It is a signal, verse 17, between me and the family builders of Israel, for the olam, to the hidden period. For in 6 days Yahweh made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested. The word rested, Shabbat, means to repose. And he was refreshed. Now there was the fundamental principle that Moses was to carry down to Israel. He found them in a state, of course, of idolatry and apostasy, doing their own things. What an antithesis it was. So, brethren and sisters, this morning we want to have a look at Israel's relationship through their history to the Sabbath. You need to have to hang on to your seats because we've got to get through this and we need to get to John chapter 5 in the next 40 minutes. So, see if you can focus on these things with me. Let's go as fast as we can, but in a measured way, to see how Israel never understood the principle of the Sabbath that was laid down here. Deuteronomy chapter 5 indicates where they failed. They failed to perceive a little hint in Deuteronomy chapter 5 which should have indicated to them that the Sabbath was not to be a negative thing but rather a positive thing. It wasn't just a matter of cessation from work. That was required. But the purpose of that was that they might focus on positive things, that they might be active in the service of their God, that they might think upon his things and not their own. They were to make something of the Sabbath. And that comes out of Deuteronomy chapter 5. Here we have, of course, the recounting of the Ten Commandments in verses 6 onwards. And we come down to verse 12 and we read, keep the Sabbath day to sanctify it. Here is our word, Shema. Guard the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the word sanctify means. As Yahweh thy God hath commanded thee, 6 days shalt thou labour and do all thy work. Just notice the language. Do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of Yahweh thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou nor thy son, nor thy daughter, and so on. List them off. Everybody in the nation was to rest, as it says at the end of verse 14, that they may rest. The word there, rest, is nuach, means to have a rest. Then in verse 15, the purpose of that rest is spelled out. And remember that thou wast a slave in the land of Egypt, and that Yahweh thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore Yahweh thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. Now you might think that the word keep there is the same word shema that occurs in verse 12. It isn't. It's a different word. It's the Hebrew word asah, A-S-A-H. And it's the same word that you find in verse 8. Thou shalt not make thee. The word make is asah. It's the same word in verse 10. And showing mercy. The word showing is asah. It's the same word in verse 12 and 13, rendered do. Do all thy work. So you see, brothers and sisters, what Yahweh was hinting at, and the Hebrew would have picked this up, even though we wouldn't in the English. They would have picked it up, that they were to make something of the Sabbath. They were to show forth something on the Sabbath. There was something to be done on the Sabbath. It wasn't just a case of inactivity, but a case of active good. Cessation from one's own works in order to perform the works of their God. But Israel never properly understood that principle. If you were to have a look in your own time in Ezekiel chapter 20, where you'll find frequent reference to the Sabbath, you will find between verses 10 and 26 that there are two or three statements repeated over again. On three occasions it says something like this: if a man do his commandments, he shall live, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. And the very next words are, don't defile the Sabbath. But if a man do his commandments, he shall live. There's a very interesting, intriguing juxtaposition of ideas in Ezekiel 20, which of course refers to Israel's wilderness wanderings as a type of the second exodus of Israel. We haven't got time to go there this morning, but have a look at that one in your own time and you'll see that juxtaposition of ideas again. The principle of this is expressed in Luke chapter 11. In Luke chapter 11, the Lord Jesus Christ bases his words upon the wilderness wanderings of Israel to hammer home the principle of the Sabbath, which they never understood. Now we know that he's referring to Israel, having come out of Egypt, and of their wilderness wanderings from verse 20 onwards, or thereabouts, because he actually quotes from Exodus chapter 8 and verse 19. Read from, say, verse 19 of Luke chapter 11 with me. And if I by Beelzebub cast out demons, by whom do your sons cast them out? You see, they'd accused him of using the power of Beelzebub, the lord of the dungheap, to work miracles. By whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore they shall be your judges. But if I with the finger of God cast out demons, no doubt the kingdom of God has come upon you. You notice that he's quoting, you see in the margin, from Exodus chapter 8 and verse 19, when the magicians of Egypt could not produce lice in the land, they said to Pharaoh, there's no doubt, this is the finger of God. And the Lord picks that up because he's talking about the overpowering of Pharaoh and his gods by the power of Yahweh to bring out his people from the bondage of Egypt. That's why the words go on to say in verse 21. When a strong man, if I might paraphrase this for you, when a strong man, Pharaoh, armed, keepeth his palace, Egypt, his goods, Israel, are in peace. But when a stronger than he, namely Yahweh, shall come upon him, and overcome him, he taketh from him all his armour wherein he trusted, and divideth his spoils, which is exactly what Israel did. He that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth. When the unclean spirit is drawn out of a man, Israel, Israel is my son, said Yahweh, he walketh through dry places, the wilderness, seeking rest, the land of promise. And finding none, he saith, I will return to my house whence I came out. They tried to make themselves a captain to go back into Egypt. And then the Lord brings home the lesson. I will return to my house, they say. And when he cometh, he findeth it swept and garnished. Then goeth he and taketh to him, look at it, seven other spirits. This is the antithesis of the Sabbath principle. Seven other spirits, more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. Our young people could tell us what that lesson was all about, brothers and sisters. It's a simple lesson, isn't it? That there is simply no good sitting idle in the truth. If you empty your life of the world, which is what we've got to do, you will never survive unless you fill it up with the truth. You cannot survive unless your life is filled with the things of God. No good emptying your mind of the rubbish of the world and switching off the TV and throwing away the magazines unless you get your Bible out and get this book in your head. Because you'll never survive. You'll end up back in Egypt worse than you were before. Children can understand that lesson. And there's the principle of the Sabbath, brothers and sisters, that Israel never understood. They came out of Egypt and they sat in that wilderness on the Sabbath day and did absolutely nothing but think about how they could get back there. That's all they could think about. How to get back into Egypt and the leeks and the garlics and the scrumptious things of the world that they left behind. But there were a few like Joshua and Caleb who filled their lives with positive things. And the Sabbath for them was not a day that wasted time. It was a day of activity in the things of God. There was the principle that Israel failed to understand. Come back to Exodus chapter 12 and you can see how this was hammered home to them. In the very first chapter, which deals with their departure from Egypt, immediately after the Passover, the introduction of the feast of unleavened bread, emphasis was laid upon this principle. In verse 14, for this is a day that shall be a memorial unto you, and ye shall keep it a feast to Yahweh throughout your generations. Teach this principle to your children. Ye shall keep it a feast by an ordinance for the Olam. It's to do with the kingdom, with everlasting life. 7 days shall ye eat unleavened bread. Even the first day you shall put away leaven out of your houses. You see, you've got to get rid of corruption out of the house. You've got to empty the house and sweep it out clean, brothers and sisters. But something has got to go back into it. Israel didn't understand that. So he goes on in this context to talk about removing leaven from the first day until the seventh day. And what he's really trying to say to them is that the Sabbath principle has got to be operative from day one until you get into the kingdom. It will be unto the Olam. And that's why seven is so predominant here in this context. Read verse 16. And in the first day there shall be a holy convocation. In the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation to you. No manner of work shall be done. There's got to be a total rest from sin, from corruption, which of course leaven represents. Leave that behind until the kingdom, from day one till day seven. And that was the lesson that Yahweh was hammering home to them. You get the same idea out of verse 17, 18, 19. It just keeps on repeating the same lesson over and over again. And when it came to the manna, brothers and sisters, in chapter 16 of Exodus, you know it as well as I do. They collected twice as much on the sixth day, and the manna of the Sabbath did not corrupt. There was no corruption on the Sabbath. There was the Sabbath principle. Now there's the first thing. Oh yes, there's a need for negatives. There's a need for separation. There's a need to abandon the things of the world, brothers and sisters. A vital need. You can never fill your life with good until you've abandoned those things. But if that's as far as you go, you are not a Sabbath people. And that's why Israel did not enter into his rest. Didn't understand it. Have a look at Leviticus 23. Here's the second requirement of a Sabbath people. We've emphasized the need to be corruption free for 7 days. Now let's look at the other side of the coin, the positive side of the coin. When we come to Leviticus 23 and verse 39, it was in the 15th day of the 7th month that they held the Feast of Tabernacles. When you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep a feast unto Yahweh 7 days. So the Sabbath principle will be predominant. And on the first day shall be a Sabbath. It might have been an ordinary day of the week, doesn't matter. It would be a Sabbath. And on the 8th day there shall be a Sabbath. And what were they to do? Verse 40. And ye shall take to you on the first day, which you'll see, of course, from verse 39, was a Sabbath. The boughs of goodly trees, branches of palm trees, and the boughs of thick trees, and the willows of the brook. Now that's working. If that had been done in the days of the Lord Jesus Christ, brothers and sisters, the Pharisees would have been up in arms. You can't cut down trees on the Sabbath day. There would have been a riot in Jerusalem if people had done that in the days of the Lord. Taken their axe and gone up to the Mount of Olives and cut down trees. You simply couldn't do it on the Sabbath day. But here Israel in the wilderness were commanded, brethren and sisters, on the first day, which was to be a special Sabbath, they were to take their axes and to cut down goodly trees and to build a flimsy house, a shelter in the open. And to lay their beds in there. And to set up their home. What was the purpose of that work? Was it for themselves? Well, of course, it was away from the comforts of home, wasn't it? They left the lounge chairs and all the comforts of the kitchen and of the home behind. They were out on the hillsides under the stars with a flimsy shelter that they might learn that Yahweh was their foundation. And they would live with it, with him for a week. What was the purpose of the work that they had to do to prepare for that? Have a look at the end of verse 40. And you shall rejoice before Yahweh your God 7 days. And there's the positive aspect of Sabbath keeping. There needs to be a rejoicing. Now some of you will already have your minds in Isaiah 58, and that's where they should be. Delighting in the Sabbath. That's the principle. We'll come there tomorrow, God willing. So here we have Israel commanded to rejoice before Yahweh their God 7 days. Why would they rejoice? Verse 43, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths or succoths. When I brought them out of the land of Egypt, I brought them out of the bondage of corruption. I've released you from corruption. I've made you a Sabbath people. Now I want you to involve yourself positively in my work and to rejoice in Yahweh your God. To delight in my Sabbaths. To do my works. That's being a Sabbath people. But tragically, they never were. Have a look at Numbers chapter 14. Now you know this context very well. It's a sad chapter, isn't it? Extremely sad. When the spies had come back, and 10 of them had given their faithless report, and even the faithfulness, the sterling faithfulness of Joshua and Caleb had been unable to turn this people away from their intention to return to Egypt, as we read in verse 3 of Numbers 14. And Yahweh steps in, brethren and sisters, and swears by his own living existence that that people would perish in the wilderness. Whereas Jesus said, your fathers ate manna in the wilderness and are dead. They'll be at the judgment seat. No question about it. There won't be one single responsible person not at the judgment seat. They'll be there. But Jesus said, they are dead.
He means dead.
And that's why this chapter has a brilliant contrast between death and life. You can pick it up by just looking at the chapter. Yahweh says in verse 21, "But as truly as I live," or as it should be, "but I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of Yahweh." But what about these other people? Verse 28, "I live," but verse 29, "your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness." Verse 32, "your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness." Verse 33 towards the end, "until your carcasses be wasted in this wilderness." Verse 35 at the end of the verse, "the faithless died, and they shall die." And they did in verse 37. "Those that brought up an evil report upon the land died by the plague before Yahweh." In verse 45, "in their presumption to take the land in their own strength, they were discomfited even unto Horma," which means utter destruction. There's death in this chapter, and that death came about because of the oath of Yahweh. The life is contrasted with death. We read in verse 38 that Joshua and Caleb lived. They lived. And they will live, brothers and sisters, forevermore. You see, this chapter is commented upon by the psalmist in Psalm 95. Keep your hand in Numbers 14. Come with me to Psalm 95. Now, Psalm 95 is said by some to be part of a larger psalm, which starts with Psalm 92. And as far as I'm aware, is the only psalm that bears the superscription, "a psalm or a song for the Sabbath day." Now, if that in fact is correct, Psalm 95 is part of this larger psalm for the Sabbath day. It's interesting, isn't it, that when we come to verse 8 of Psalm 95, we should find ourselves confronted with the issues of the Sabbath as far as Israel were concerned. "Harden not your heart," as in the provocation. The word provocation there is Meribah, rendered by some with the proper name. "Harden not your heart," as in Meribah. Now, there were two Meribahs. There was one in Exodus 17, verse 7, at the beginning of the wilderness wanderings at Rephidim, and there was another in Numbers chapter 20 and verse 13 at Kadesh Barnea. Both of those places, of course, saw water coming out of the rock. "Harden not your heart," as in Meribah. That's why it says in verse 10, 40 years long was I grieved with this generation. And there was about 40 years between those two Meribahs, Exodus 17 and Numbers 20. But he says in the middle of verse 8, "as in the day of temptation." That word temptation there is rendered by some with a name, Massa. There was only one Massa, and that was in Exodus 17, verse 7. The place was called Massa and Meribah. So here we see the psalmist summing up the entire history of Israel in the wilderness. "It was a history when your fathers," verse 9, "tempted me," the word means tested, "proved me to investigate God," is the idea of the word. They investigated me and proved me and saw my work by, of course, challenging his righteousness and his presence. "Is Yahweh among us or not?" That's how they tested him. 40 years long, he says in verse 10, "was I grieved with this generation." That word grieved there means to be disgusted with someone. And it's in the durative imperfect tense in the Hebrew. If you really wanted to be literal about it, it says this: "I kept feeling a loathing for this people. I kept feeling a loathing for this people. And I said, it is a people that do err in their heart, and they have not known my ways, unto whom I swear in my wrath that they should not enter into my rest." Now you'll notice the margin. If you have the same margin as me, it says Hebrew, "if they enter into my rest." That doesn't sound very sensible to us, but it is in fact a Hebrew idiom that intensifies the negative. It's a way of saying, they shall not, they shall never get the idea of that. they shall never enter into my rest. Picked up in the Greek, actually, in Hebrews chapter 4. It simply means, they shall never, ever, ever, ever enter into my rest. Why not? Because they never understood the Sabbath principle. That's why not. But then there came another generation, back in Numbers 14 and 15. Now I don't know, brothers and sisters, whether you are very familiar with this section of Numbers, but there are some curiosities here. Do you know that in the 38 years of Israel's history, from their condemnation in Numbers 14, until they came to the borders of the land, or at least, though, to be accurate, until they came to Kadesh Barnea, in that 38 years, there are only two incidents recorded. It's a long time, isn't it, to live out your life as 500 or 600 people per week had to die in order for the old generation, 20 and above, to perish from their midst. You imagine it, 500 funerals in the Brotherhood every week. You'd get the point, wouldn't you? They shall not enter into my rest. Everybody 20 and above, except of course for a handful, was to perish in that wilderness. But there was a younger generation. The two incidents that are referred to in Numbers 15 through 18 are, of course, the rebellion of Korah, Dathan and Abiram, which are treated of in Numbers 16 to 18. And the man who was stoned to death for gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. It's in Numbers 15. And that man, brethren and sisters, is a microcosm of the condemned nation. Because you see, he was a Sabbath despiser. He detested the Sabbath principle. He defied it. And he died under a pile of stones. As a representative man, he represented every one of that nation who had been condemned to perish in that wilderness in Numbers chapter 14 by the divine oath. We'll see that in a minute. But there was the younger generation, wasn't there? And that is the purpose of Numbers chapter 15. Now, I want you to have a very careful look at this. Verses 1 and 2 of chapter 15. Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel. You see, the words are language of appeal again. When ye be come into the land of your habitations, which I give unto you. You see, this must be a reference to the younger generation. Because the older ones, 20 and above, as we're told in the previous chapter in verse 29, would all perish in that wilderness. Except for Joshua and Caleb and the Levites. They would all perish. But here is a generation who would come into the land. They would have to wait 38 years to get there. 38 long years because of their parents. And then we read on. When you come into the land, he says in verse 3, and will make an offering by fire unto Yahweh, a burnt offering or a sacrifice in performing a vow or a freewill offering, or in your solemn feast to make a sweet savour unto Yahweh of the herd or the flock. I'll just pause there for a minute. I shouldn't, but I will. He says, when you come into the land, you'll be like your fathers. Just like your fathers in the wilderness, who for the next 38 years will make their burnt offerings and their peace offerings. And I want you to make burnt offerings and peace offerings. The burnt offering stands for total dedication. Mentally, morally, physically, because they laid the head on the altar first. Then, of course, the fat of the innards, and then the innards and the legs last. Yahweh wants, brothers and sisters, our minds, and he wants our hearts first, before our actions. And you'll make your peace offerings to signify that you desire to have fellowship with me. Fine. I want that, but I want something else as well. So let's just read verses 3 and 4 again, just the last part of verse 3. In your solemn feasts, they make all these sacrifices in the solemn feast to make a sweet savour unto Yahweh of the herd or the flock. Then, underline the word, brethren and sisters, It's repeated three times in this chapter, the same principle. Then shall he that offereth his offering unto Yahweh bring a meal offering as it should be, and the tenth deal of flour mingled with the fourth part of a hin of oil, and the fourth part of a hin of wine for a drink offering shalt thou prepare with a burnt offering or sacrifice for one lamb. And so it goes on in that vein. The same thing is said in verses 8 and 9. When thou preparest, verse 8, a bullock for a burnt offering, and for a sacrifice in performing a vow, or peace offerings unto Yahweh, then shall he bring with it, what? A meal offering of 3/10 deals of flour, and a drink offering in verse 10, that it might be a sweet savour unto Yahweh. The same principle occurs in verse 18 and 19. Verse 18, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when ye become into the land, whither I bring you, then it shall be that when ye eat of the bread of the land, ye shall offer up a heave offering unto Yahweh. The heave offering represented surrender. I want you to indicate to me that you are surrendering to me. Ye shall offer up a cake of the first of your dough for a heave offering. As ye do the heave offering of the threshing floor, so shall ye heave it. In other words, brethren and sisters, what Yahweh was telling this new generation, whose parents were not a Sabbath people and would not enter into his rest, is that when he brought them into the rest, they would have to demonstrate their understanding of why they were there. It is absolutely no good declaring your intentions to serve God by burnt and peace. It is no good coming to the meetings and indicating your desire for fellowship if you do not have the intention to serve him when you leave and perform what you intend. And that was the meaning of a meal offering and a drink offering. It was easy enough to grab hold of a bullock or a ram and to lead it to the altar and to let the priest cut its throat with your hand on its head. Didn't hurt anybody except the sacrifice. But it wasn't so easy to go out and to plough the field in the cold and rain, and to sow the seed, and to reap the crop after waiting for months for it to grow, and then to grind it to powder and to sift it into the finest flour, and then to make fine cakes for a meal offering. That wasn't so easy. And it wasn't easy to harvest the grapes and to tread them out and to wait until the wine had been produced. That was hard work. It wasn't easy to go out to the olive tree and to bring down the olives and to stamp them and to sift out the pure oil of the olive, brethren and sisters. All of those things were required, you saw there in verses 4 and 5 of Numbers 15. They all required hard work, as does the producing of oil that burns brightly in the minds of Yahweh's servants, as does the labour that gives him a sweet savour, brethren and sisters. It all requires commitment and dedication and hard work and consistency. You can't just say, well, look, I don't really feel like ploughing today. I don't really feel like harvesting today. It's got to be done. And so Yahweh says to this new generation, your fathers perished because they were not truly a Sabbath people. When I bring you into your rest, you make sure you live the way that Christadelphians ought to live. Otherwise you don't deserve to be in that land. Your profession must be matched by your performance. And if it's not, I'll take you out of that land. And you'll end up like the man who was found gathering sticks on the Sabbath day under a pile of stones, who represented your parents. You know what, brethren and sisters? Six times in this chapter the phrase, a sweet savour unto Yahweh, is mentioned. You'll find it, and these are worth marking in, actually. You'll find it in verse 3. You see the phrase, a sweet savour unto Yahweh? Verse 7. A sweet savour unto Yahweh, and so again in verse 10, verse 13, verse 14, and verse 24. Now that's an extremely interesting phrase. It is the Hebrew words, Riak Nikoak. I won't attempt to spell them here. But Nikoak comes from Newark, which we've met already this morning. And Newark is cognate with Manukar, which is the word in Psalm 95 verse 11, they shall not enter into my rest. And if you really wanted to have a literal translation of that phrase, you would render it this way, a fragrance of rest. Now you read that again in verse 3. In your solemn feast when you make these sacrifices, to make a fragrance of rest unto Yahweh your God, if you understand the principle of activity. Of activity. Not just professing your service, but performing it. If you understand that, you will give Yahweh a fragrance of rest. You know why, brothers and sisters? When you and I are busy in the truth work, when we are active in the Father's work, He can rest. He can rest. Because we're not doing things that will give Him displeasure, frustrate His purpose, and require Him to be active to turn us back to the right way. It's like the angel that is with us. He doesn't have to work that hard. When we are busily engaged in the work of the truth, He can rest. There's a fragrance of rest. The angels are having a rest now, outside this hall perhaps. There are at least 350 angels somewhere in the grounds of this place. And they're resting. Because our minds are busily engaged in divine things. That's not a dream, that's a reality. And these people were to be active in the truth that God might have a fragrance of rest. Can you come with me to John chapter 5? For 38 years, that generation had to wait to come into the land to be made whole. Because of their fathers who were not truly a Sabbath people. And there came a day, brothers and sisters, when the Lord Jesus Christ came to Jerusalem for a purpose. He came in at Passover time in verse 1, or at least we think it was Passover time, at the Feast of the Jews. And He went up to Jerusalem. Now there is a Jerusalem by the sheep market, a pool which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda. It means the house of chesed, the house of mercy, which of course is the reason why it had five porches. Five being the number of grace or mercy. And in these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind and halt and withered, waiting for the moving of the water, which is exactly what the new generation had to do. They had to wait for the moving of the water. And the water was only going to move when the feet of the priest bearing the ark went into the Jordan. And then the waters would move back through Adam, brothers and sisters, and they would cross over into their rest. How long? Were they waiting? 38 years. You know what's coming, don't you? Now Jesus came into this place, brethren and sisters, and He stepped over writhing bodies. He picked His way through piles of writhing bodies all over the place to find one man. We know that. From verse 13, He only wanted to find one man. The end of verse 13 says that Jesus had conveyed Himself away, a multitude being in that place. Now you imagine what the response would have been when Jesus healed that one man and there are absolutely hundreds of diseased people lying in that place, in the house of mercy. Do you think the Son of God could have stayed there and listened to their pleas and to their cries? Jesus, thou Son of David, have mercy on us! He couldn't stay there. He had to get out. Because you see, He only came looking for one man. Just one. And we read of him in verse 5. And a certain man was there, which had an infirmity, 38 years. You know who he represents, don't you? Had an infirmity, 38 years. And what was he waiting for? Verse 4. This was their tradition. For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Just like the priests who entered the Jordan with the ark to lead the new generation into the land. But of course it was nonsense. They thought this happened. They thought that the first who got into the water after the troubling thereof was made whole of whatsoever disease he had. But you see, brethren and sisters, the one who had to enter that water as the ark of Yahweh had not yet stepped into the water, that it might flow back through Adam. That was still a little way off. But he was to signify the redemption of Israel. So he came looking for that one man. What does he do? He says in verse 6, when Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he said unto him, are you willing to be made whole? And the word whole occurs 6 times in this context. 6 times to represent the fullness of man. And the impotent man answered, sir, I have no man, when the water is troubled, to put me into the pool. But while I am coming, another steppeth down before me. Jesus said to him, rise, take up thy bed and walk. And immediately the man was made whole and took up his bed and walked. And on the same day, look at it, on the same day was the Sabbath. Typically, it was the kingdom. It was the Sabbath. And Israel will be healed, brethren and sisters. They will be healed as a nation. They will be made whole. Because then they will understand the Sabbath principle. But look at the generation back then, verse 10. The Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, it is the Sabbath day. It is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed. He answered them, he that made me whole, the same said to me, do some work. Take up thy bed and stop sleeping. That's what we do on a bed, isn't it? Take up your bed of sleeping and sickness, and get out and do some work. And he did it. He went out and preached. You know what Jesus said to him when he found him later in the temple in verse 14? Afterward Jesus findeth him in the temple and said unto him, behold, thou art made whole. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come unto thee. Or he could have said to him, brethren and sisters, be active in the truth and give Yahweh a fragrance of rest.